This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Cinderella is back on the big screen. This time, it's a live-action film directed by Kenneth Branagh, starring Lily James of Downton Abbey fame in the starring role, Kate Blanchett as the evil stepmother, and Helena Bonham Carter as the fairy godmother. I saw it this past weekend in a theater filled with 9-year-old girls who were enthralled by the story. There are many versions of this classic fairy tale, and this one, like the 1950 Disney animated movie, has its roots in a French story written several centuries ago. Today on Radio Times, all things Cinderella, why this story endures. We have two guests who have joined us. Linda Holmes writes and edits NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog called Monkey See. In fact, joins us from the studios of NPR. Linda Holmes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Maria Tatar, and she is chair of the Folklore and Mythology Program at Harvard University. And Maria, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. We need to get Maria set up, so we will try to figure that out. I'm just sort of vamping here because I'm looking through the screen here. I did want to play a clip from the movie, but I didn't want to do it until we have both of our guests up. But to you, Linda Holmes, I assume you have watched this Kenneth Branagh version of Cinderella. What was your takeaway?
I actually really enjoyed it. I think it's a beautifully shot movie. I think that it incorporates a lot of the Disney elements, but it also it's also trying to modernize this story a little bit. I think it's playing a little bit with some of the gendered elements in a kind of a post-Frozen, post-Brave landscape, trying to make her have some qualities that they think appeal now more to little girls, perhaps, than were considered to be important in the 1600s.
Well, I have to say, I was sitting next to a little girl, and she was just, I don't think she ate one piece of her popcorn. She was so enthralled with the movie. And I have to say, I know what the story is about, and I found myself tearing up.
Well, there's a reason why this story is not just hundreds but thousands of years old in various versions. It is affecting, and I think there is something about this story that both because it has that kind of social resonance and because people often remember it, some version of it from their own childhoods. And whether you're somebody who has strong memories of the Disney animated version or you're someone who has strong memories of the Julie Andrews musical version that was on television or someone who really loved the Drew Barrymore version in 1997, people often have some connection to this story that means something to them. Not everyone, but for a lot of people, there's something here to this story in their life of taking in storytelling.
In fact, we have some of those versions queued up, but it sounds like we have Maria Tatar with us on Radio Times. And Maria, nice to have you with us on the show.
Great to be here.
Sorry about that sort of pregnant pause there getting the show started. I actually do want to play a clip from the brand new Cinderella. This is directed by Kenneth Branagh. And this is a scene where Cinderella meets the prince in the woods for the very first time. They're both on horseback. He, in this meeting, calls himself Kit, so she actually has no idea that he's a prince. But let's give it a listen, and then, Maria, I'll get your response to this new version of Cinderella.
Where do you live, Mr. Kit?
At the palace. My father's teaching me his trade.
You're an apprentice?
Of a sort.
That's very fine. Do they treat you well?
Oh, better than I deserve, most likely. And you?
They treat me as well as they are able.
I'm sorry.
It's not your doing.
Nor yours either, I'll bet.
It's not so very bad. Others have it worse, I'm sure. We must simply have courage and be kind, mustn't we?
Yes. You're right. That's exactly how I feel.
And that's a scene from the new Cinderella. Maria, before you came on, Lynn and I were talking about our reaction to this new version of Cinderella. What's yours?
Well, let me start with the upside. First of all, a great cast. Kate Blanchett, Lily James, Helena Bonham Carter, and fabulous costumes. I think the Times described it as a costume romance.
Yes.
For mothers and daughters.
Absolutely.
And there you have that wonderful connectivity that Linda was talking about. This is a story that gives us something to talk about. We all can weigh in. We remember the version we saw or heard as a child, or the ones that circulate in our culture constantly. Now, all of that said, I did worry about the fact that this felt a little bit like a step backward after Frozen and Maleficent, which were so inventive and engaging. That is, it wasn't just the old. Somehow, I think in those two films, Disney hit the refresh button in great ways. And I sort of feel as if here we're going back three centuries to the Cinderella, as you mentioned, of Charles Perrault.
And is that because of this sort of focus on kindness? I mean, she talks about courage and kindness. That's the sort of mantra that we hear through this Cinderella, Maria.
Yes, kindness. And for that, you know, I focus on one of the final scenes where Cinderella turns to the stepmother and she says, "I forgive you," in the cruelest, most cutting way. And that scene is very powerful because I think it reminds us that kindness is a very complicated virtue and that there can be a passive-aggressive quality in it, too. So, you know, we do get this sort of mantra-like repetition of kindness and courage. I sort of wish it had been more brains and courage, something like that, or curiosity and courage. How about that?
Well, let me toss that to you, Linda Holmes. And some of the reviews that I've read talk about this Cinderella as a kind of doormat. What do you make of the kindness and the courage?
You know, I think for me, I tend toward that idea that kindness and forgiveness are, in fact, often very brave qualities to have. And I think that very often, you know, I think films and pop culture in general right now are going through a period where to be a strong character, particularly to be a strong female character, means kind of one thing or one group of things. It means fighting. It means being able to be involved in physical combat, or it means, you know, being controlling and powerful and incredibly motivated by your own interests and your own desires. And I think those are all very good things. They're all very important things to add to the world of what it means to be a strong person. But there are people for whom to be a strong person does mean to recover from people being unkind to you and to be able to say, "I forgive you," to be able to say, "I am a kind person. I've remained a kind person in spite of all of the things that have happened in my life." So although I am always in favor of kind of diversifying the idea of what female characters are allowed to be, and I would never want to see a world where the only thing that was valued about girls and women in particular was kindness, was sweetness, was generosity. Kindness and sweetness and generosity are okay things to value in characters. And I did feel that about this. I felt like this young woman, she's choosing to be kind. She's choosing to be forgiving to people. And that can be an act of great strength.
And without giving too much away, when she forgives her stepmother looks absolutely devastated.
Well, there is an effort, I think, to complicate the character of the stepmother a little bit, which also happened in the Drew Barrymore version where that character was played by Angelica Houston. There's an idea of bringing the stepmother a little bit of humanity in that she feels, you know, that perhaps she could have been a mother figure for Cinderella had she been a different person, had she been less wounded and damaged herself. So you can kind of look at that exchange and say, if someone had been kinder to her when she was younger, perhaps she wouldn't have turned out that way.
You know, this is a weird segue, but I'm going to do it anyway, and I'm going to toss it to you, Maria. I'm looking at an article about Monet Davis, the young baseball star from Philadelphia who wowed people at the Little League championship both on and off the field. She recently, or just yesterday, forgave a guy that did a really insulting tweet about her, and she basically said, "I forgive you," and took the high road, showed herself to be a kind and courageous young woman.
Oh, yeah, I think that's great. And, Lindy, those were many valid points. I think with the film, what troubled me was that we were told the message rather than shown it. And I think somehow children in particular resist being hit over the head with a message. They want to see it. They want to see the story unfold. And they will take away the lesson when they see kindness on display. It seemed to me that the film just repeated it a few too many times. And, you know, I wanted to say, yes, we get it. We get it. And it's a good message to communicate. But I can get that by watching this film and seeing how Lily James reacts, how the character of Cinderella reacts.
There is, Maria, in this story and other fairy tales as well, there seems to always be a stepmother of some sort, a fairy godmother. What do they represent as you look at the sort of mythology of folklores?
Well, I think growing up, we are all surrounded by ogres and giants. there's the good mother, as the psychologists tell us, there's a good, kind mother who feeds you, who nurtures you, who nourishes you. And then there's a mother who does get mad at you and is mean and cruel. And what fairy tales do is to give us this exaggerated, grotesque form of that cruel mother. They let us sort of process our hostility to our mothers. Now, interestingly, you know, if you go back to Italy in the 16th century, you find that there's a Cinderella figure who actually kills her stepmother.
Huh.
She's sort of goaded on to do this by the governess who wants to marry the girl's father. But you do get these wonderfully interesting. Basically, you know, fairy tales take us into the world of the hyper-dysfunctional family. It's as bad as it gets, worst-case scenarios. And, you know, then I think we begin to see that our lives are actually not that bad. Or if this one made it, it gives us, if that person got out of that terrible situation and lived happily ever after, then there's hope for us, too.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Maria Tatar. She's chair of the Folklore and Mythology Program at Harvard University, teaches German studies, folklore, children's literature, also translator of The Turnip Princess and other newly discovered fairy tales. Also with us is Linda Holmes, and she writes and edits NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog, Monkey See. We are talking about Cinderella in this hour of Radio Times. There's a new live-action film directed by Kenneth Branagh, just opened over the weekend, and of course, many versions going back in time. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and we have some more clips from more movies as well. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Linda Holmes down in D.C. and Maria Tatar up in Boston. We are talking about all things Cinderella in this hour of Radio Times. And I do want to play the famous song from the 1950 Disney animated version of Cinderella, Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo. Let's give it a listen.
Salagadoola, Metricaboola, Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo. Put them together, and what have you got? Bibbidi bobbidi boo. Salagadoola, mentricaboola, bibbidi bobbidi boo. It'll do magic, believe it or not. Bibbidi bobbidi boo. Now salagadoola means a mentricaboola roo. But the thing about that does the job is bibbidi bobbidi boo.
And Linda, would it be fair to say that the sort of American version of this story is pretty G-rated. Yes, it goes back to these French roots, but you wrote a really fascinating piece about all the various versions of Cinderella, many of them much more horrifying than I think what we're used to seeing in this country.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing because when you talk to people about this story, a lot of people say, oh, you know, there are very, very dark versions. Like, you know, in the Brothers Grimm version, the stepsisters get their eyes pecked out by birds. And then you want to just look at them and say, boy, you have seen nothing until you have read some of these variants where the sisters eat the mother. And I mean, there is a lot of eating of people that goes on in versions of this story. It is a story with a lot of really dark, weird variants for sure.
To you, Maria, there's eating and cannibalism, I think, in a lot of fairy tales. What is that about?
Yeah, I always think of what John Updike said about fairy tales. They're the television and pornography of an earlier age. And I think, you know, today we associate fairy tales with children. What has been our portal to fairy tales but Disney? These cartoon versions that have been sanitized and made child-friendly. But if you go back, you realize, you know, these are the stories that kept adults awake. They're stories that were told to the rhythms of labor, and they had to be, you know, to keep interest up. There was violence. There were all kinds of racy body episodes in these stories.
And cannibalism is, you know, just to dig a little bit deeper here, is obviously devouring someone, sort of becoming that person.
Well, sure, but I think more importantly, the fear that you are going to be eaten up by someone. Many fairy tales begin in times of hunger. There's a famine in the land. These are stories that were told at times when there was very little to eat. And of course, there are always stories circulating about cannibalism. But I think, again, take it back to the young child, too. You know, today I think we have adults who embrace children and say, oh, you're good enough to eat up. You know, I'd like to. And they start nibbling on the child. So I think the cannibalism motif speaks to many different anxieties that we have as children and also as adults. So these are stories that help us process those fears.
And I would think, Linda, you know, back centuries ago, many women died in childbirth. So the idea of a stepmother, whatever version that was not unusual.
Right. And I think that what you see in Cinderella is very often a variety of different mother figures. As we were talking about earlier, people see mothers in so many different ways. Cinderella very often has a birth mother who has passed away. She has a stepmother who is unloving and withholding. And then she has a fairy godmother who becomes kind of the supernatural complement to the shortcomings of her flesh and blood stepmother. And so what you see are kind of a lot of these kind of ideas that people are processing about mothers and children. And, you know, it's interesting because the American Cinderella is usually a Cinderella where the father has died. But there are other versions of Cinderella where the father, and this is true of the Brothers Grimm version, which a lot of people have seen in Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, in which the father is alive, but he's indifferent and he's unhelpful. And there are even, you know, there are versions of kind of related stories, not really Cinderella, but related stories where the father actually wants to marry the daughter. And that's why she has to flee, is that after the death of her mother, her father wants to marry her. You know, speaking of kind of dark and upsetting themes. So
sure.
There's a lot of stuff being processed with kind of parental figures and ideas about family.
Well, Maria, I remember when my son was little and I started reading probably Grimm's Brothers fairy tales to him. And then thinking, oh, and now I'm going to send you to bed, have a really nice sleep. Meanwhile, we've talked about abandonment and evil stepmothers. I mean, for children, it's a way of processing things, but it's odd that we would read it to them and then wish them a good night's sleep.
Well, we haven't talked about the element of hope. And I think one of the reasons Cinderella is so powerful is it's a story about transformation and metamorphosis. The possibility of change. You can be the ugly duckling and turn into the beautiful swan. no matter how bad it is, things will change, and you will find a way to a new home, one that isn't toxic like the other one. I think what's very powerful about this new Disney Cinderella is it's almost an antidote to all the dystopian fiction that we're getting for young adults these days. What are we seeing on screen but Hunger Games and Divergent and, you know, talk about dark. Those are really dark because the heroines are constantly assaulted and besieged. And I think Cinderella says things can change, things will get better. And sometimes, you know, it's not even just kindness, courage, curiosity, or any of those other virtues, but just waiting it out until you grow up and you have power in your own hands.
Well, Linda, as I was watching Cinderella, I was thinking of Katniss and the Hunger Games. I mean, just what a different experience that obviously is. But it seems that we don't have to choose between those two kinds of characters. We can be them all.
Well, yeah, you know, in the rest of popular culture, we call that being a boy, you know, because you have boys who are lots of different ways. You have boys who are curious and quiet and intellectual and thoughtful. You have boys who are strong and fight and you know, have a lot of overt power. You have boys who do magic. You have boys who are all kinds of things. And I think the struggle with girls has been to develop a lot of different kinds of girls. It's not a matter of figuring out what's the right way to be a girl, what's the right way to be a woman in a movie or a woman in a story or a little girl in a movie or a story. The point is to try to have a complex array of girls and women the same way that you have a complex array of boys and men.
Well, I do want to reintroduce you, and I also do want to play another piece from In My Own Little Corner. This is actually sung by Julie Andrews, and she played Cinderella in the Rodgers and Hammerstein version of what was the first live broadcast. This goes back to 1957. Let me reintroduce the two of you, also give out the phone number, then I do want to play that clip. Linda Holmes writes and edits NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog called Monkey See. Maria Tatar is chair of the Folklore and Mythology Program at Harvard University. And yes, we are talking about Cinderella in this hour of the show. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And again, let me play. This is just a short version of Julie Andrews singing In My Own Little Corner. She played Cinderella back in 1957, a song composed by Rodgers and Hammerstein.
I'm as mild and as meek as a mouse. When I hear a command, I obey. But I know of a spot in my heart where no one can stand in my way. In my own little corner, in my own little chair, I can be whatever I want to be. On the wing of my fancy, I can fly anywhere, and the world will open its arms to me. I'm a young Norwegian princess or a milkmaid. I'm the greatest prima donna in Milan. I'm an heiress who has always had her silk made by her own flock of silkworms in Japan.
And again, that's Julie Andrews playing the part of Cinderella. Maria, what kind of Cinderella was Julie Andrews?
Oh, I see her as possessing this powerful imagination. She can go anywhere she wants. I'm immediately reminded of the Shawshank Redemption and how all the men are liberated when they hear Mozart. They're freed from prison because their minds are so completely mesmerized and preoccupied by the beauty of the music. And so there she is. She liberates herself through her imagination and, you know, thinking of possibilities, which is, of course, the first step toward action.
Linda, how do you see this portrayal of Cinderella?
I adore that portrayal, and I adore that broadcast. I hadn't seen it in full. It was not available for a long time, but it's on DVD now. I loved it, and I love, you know, that's a very young Julie Andrews.
Yeah.
Before she was doing feature films when she was still a stage actress. And, you know, for me, what I liked about that when I watched it is that's only a few years after the Disney animated Cinderella in 1950. But what you see in that version is you see a Cinderella who, rather than just saying, my dream is for all my wishes to come true, which is sort of a circular, slightly contentless version of wishing and dreaming, she has these very, as Maria was talking about, specific visions of, you know, going on safari and having beautiful things, but also doing exciting things. And she talks, you know, about going and hunting and trying to, you know, get big animals. And I mean, it's she has specific thoughts about what she wants rather than just, you know, I dream, I wish, I want my wishes to come true.
And sort of rather than letting the fates kind of decide her fate, she wants to take things into her own hands.
Right. And in fact, when she has contact with the fairy godmother, she is the one who sort of prods the fairy godmother, at least on the surface, kind of prods the fairy godmother into doing all of this for her, into setting her up to go to the dance. And so it's a sort of an interesting experiment with having her be a little bit more active. And yet, you know, it's still Cinderella. Mm.
Oh, we have an email from Robert. I do not know the answer to this. He said, why did Kenneth Branagh make this movie? Do you know, Linda?
Well, I mean, I don't know specifically. My feeling, you know, my sense of this is Cinderella is one of the Disney princesses, and that now there's this kind of whole Disney princess racket that involves Jasmine and Sleeping Beauty and Snow White and kind of the traditional ones, but also the new ones like, you know, Merida and Ariel and all that business. And now the Frozen princesses, of course. And you know, I think that they are trying to kind of expand that idea. They haven't done a new Disney Cinderella in quite a while. And so, you know, my sense is it's refreshing
the right
princess for the, well, you know, everybody gets a Cinderella for their childhood, I think. And that's kind of, I mean, I suspect that at least some of the imperatives here are company oriented. If that makes sense.
It does make sense. Sadly, it does. I do want to play another version of Cinderella. This is Whitney Houston playing the fairy godmother, and Brandy actually is Cinderella. This is from the 1997 TV movie version of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, and let's give it a listen. This is a song called Impossible.
Impossible for a plain yellow pumpkin to become a golden carriage. Impossible for a plain country bumpkin and a prince to join in marriage. And four white mice will never be four white horses. Such fal-de-rol and fiddle-dee-dee, of course, is impossible. But the world is full of zanies and fools who don't believe in sensible rules and won't believe what sensible people say. And because these daft and dewy-eyed dopes keep building up impossible hopes, impossible things are happening every day. Impossible, 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 impossible.
So what did you think of that version, Maria Tatar?
Well, I love the way that it enacts the golden rule of fairy tales. That is, the impossible becomes possible. These are stories that give us counterfactuals. They are the great what-ifs. And so, you know, that song is just beautiful in giving that message.
And Linda, what's your take on this version of Cinderella?
Well, one of the things that's really interesting about that version is that it's one of the few times that the American kind of popular culture Cinderella has been played by an actress of color, despite the fact that Cinderella versions exist all around the world in many, many different cultures. The American Cinderella is almost always a white girl, as she is in the new Disney version. So one of the things that I think was interesting and is historically kind of makes that version stand out is that you did have this cast of African-American actors and also some my recollection is that Prince Charming was played by, I want to say, he was Filipino-American. Mm. And so you had a cast that looked a little different from what we usually get with the American Cinderella.
And this new Cinderella, the prince is, I guess, side man in a way.
Yes.
He's African-American. And there is one, I think, African-American family part of the courtiers.
Yeah. It's a very interesting thing because the main cast is primarily white actors, with the exception of that side man you mentioned, who I think that's a terrific performance. I liked a lot.
Me too.
But the kingdom in general is actually quite diverse. If you look at kind of the crowd scenes, so it's one of those things where, you know, if you're interested in more diversity in some of these movies, you gain a little. You lose a little, you sort of have some progress, but still, as I said, usually American Cinderellas are white girls.
And Maria, we're almost up on a break. Anything you want to add to that?
Oh, I guess I'm just a little worried about the fact that all the women are blondes.
Oh.
even the ones that are not natural blondes. Helena Bonham Carter, I think, has turned into a blonde. But yes, I think you're exactly right about, you know, there's two steps forward, one step back in a way. And, you know, I think, you know, a little more diversity would have been welcome in that film.
Well, as I said, we're almost up on a break here. And I kept thinking to myself, is Lily James really, is her waist really that small? Or did they do that digitally?
Crazy.
I do not know the answer to that. We're taking a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about Cinderella, the many iterations of Cinderella, talking with Maria Tatar. She's chair of the Folklore and Mythology Program at Harvard University. Linda Holmes writes and edits NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog called Monkey See. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. It's all things Cinderella in this hour of the show. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with NPR's Linda Holmes and Harvard's Maria Tatar. We are talking about all things Cinderella and why her story endures. Let me get Sherry Ann from Center City, Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Sherry Ann. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to just connect with the theme about transformation. And My Cinderella in Our House is really Saint Trillon from the Caribbean by Robert Sanssouci. And that's from the point of view of the godmother. And I think it's important to just, the two things that have been coming up so far is when we think about transformation, Cinderella is about transformation for the boy and the girl in adulthood. That's facilitated by the godmother because it spurs action for the prince to leave his family, to go into adulthood and marry Cinderella. And then the other transformation is this notion that, you know, in the Branagh's view, these predominantly white cast, the Cinderellas hold all the sweetness and goodness and kindness. And then, of course, you have that good mother as opposed to the great, terrible mother who, you know, is, you know, the stepmother. And if we really think about the fairy tale and the tradition of the myth, I think Maria will attest to, is that the great mother will have both. Cinderella can have some anger, as she does in the end, the passive aggressiveness, I forgive you, but it's not really shown. It's really this sweetness that, you know, almost makes you choke, and then all the anger just stays in the stepmother. And I think girls would benefit from knowing that they can be both.
Well, Sherrianna, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and Maria, just picking up on that. I mean, it is, I guess, bottom line, a story about transformation, not just for Cinderella, but also for her prince.
Well, it was such an interesting comment, too, because I think Cinderella can go in two directions. There's the revenge fantasy, and Linda mentioned some of those versions in which, you know, the stepsisters get their eyes pecked out. In one version, Cinderella cuts up her stepsister and sends her to the stepmother in a little package that has the label salt meat. But then you have the Perrault version, the one that inspired Disney, in which Cinderella forgives the stepsisters and marries them off. So it's fascinating to me that you can end with these two different tableaus, and that's where the kindness seems to me, that it may be that the Disney scriptwriters saw all those revenge fantasies and therefore felt all the more compelled to bring kindness into the story and make it so important.
Well, Linda, those two sisters are the, you know, personified mean girls, are they not, that we know?
Yeah, they are. And it's funny, one of the versions of the story that I talked about in the piece that I wrote is a very bad movie that starred Hilary Duff as a Cinderella character who, in her version of the story, it's kind of a modern version where she's a girl going to high school, and her stepmother runs a diner and she has to work in the diner and all that business. But one of the interesting things about that one is that the stepsisters are kind of ugly, nerdy, awkward girls. And so there is, in addition to her being tormented by the stepsisters, there's also a group of beautiful, popular girls, almost as if you kind of have to have both of those images of what the terrible tormentors of a young woman might look like, that on the one hand, you might have those ugly, awkward stepsisters, which is very much the American Disney version of the stepsisters, is that they're ugly and awkward. Whereas in some versions, they're beautiful and fair. They're just awful people. And that's, so this version kind of has both of those in the form of the stepsisters and then like the nice, beautiful, popular girls who are also terrible to her.
And this Hilary Duff movie that you said was so awful, she loses her phone, right? Not her slipper.
Yes. She's got her flip phone strapped to her shoe and she loses her phone at the dance.
Oh, goodness gracious. So, Maria Tatar, what is this glass slipper? What does that symbolize to you?
Oh, well, fairy tales always have these beautiful objects, sometimes made of gold, silver, glass, metallic, something that sparkles and shines. And to me, it's often the most memorable moment in the story or in the film. When the shoe is pulled out, the camera just caresses it lovingly. And it is a source of fascination and wonder and beauty. So I'm all for the shoe fetish in that.
Are we talking sex here, Maria Tatar?
Well, Sex in the City, you know, you brought it up.
There you go.
I mean, there you see how that fairy tale trope of the lost shoe circulates and in so many stories that aren't really even Cinderella stories. It comes up in Mad Men when one of the advertising guys says, I always thought fairy tales were really about necrophilia rather than shoes.
What a great line.
You have all those Sleeping Beauties and Snow White and all of that. So I love those objects that sparkle and shine in fairy tales.
Well, let me play a clip from Ever After. This is a scene from the 1998 film Ever After, inspired by Cinderella. This stars Drew Barrymore as Cinderella, Doug Gray Scott as the prince, Angelica Houston as the stepmother. And this is a scene where Cinderella and the prince are talking about a shoe.
Danielle. Perhaps you would be so kind as to help me find the owner of this rather remarkable shoe.
Where did you find that?
She is my match in every way. Please tell me I haven't lost her.
It belongs to a peasant, Your Highness, who only pretended to be a courtier to save a man's life.
Yes, I know. And the name's Henry, if you don't mind.
And again, a scene from Ever After. So, Linda Holmes, what's your take on that version of Cinderella?
I love that one. That's one of my favorites. That is one that is that I find terribly charming. It's very explicitly interested in overturning or at least examining some of the really super gendered elements of this story. So you have her being a much more assertive, independent person who meets him kind of in an act of social activism of a sort, as she said, trying to save a man's life. And she kind of toward the end of the story saves herself rather than being saved. And in my favorite little twist in that story that makes it kind of explicitly humanist and grounded and rejects the magical elements of this story, instead of having a fairy godmother, she meets Leonardo da Vinci, who's just kind of frolicking through France. They meet up and he winds up being that helping figure of the fairy godmother. And there's not a much more emphatic way to say you can make this a lovely story and not have it be a story about magic, but a story about people helping and caring about each other than to replace the fairy godmother with Leonardo da Vinci. I just find it terribly charming.
Maria, just a quick question. I probably should have asked this from the very beginning of the show. How far back do we have to go to find the roots of this story, Cinderella?
Well, we can go to China in the 9th century and find that there's a tale recorded there that is a version of Cinderella. And in that case, it's a fish, a magical fish, that provides Cinderella with this beautiful cloak made of feathers and shoes that are exquisite. But of course, you know, we only have these written versions. There's no doubt that the story was circulating orally. It did emerge from an oral storytelling tradition. So my sense is that, like Little Red Riding Hood, which is about the predator-prey relationship and about innocence and seduction, is a story that, you know, was told as soon as human beings began putting words together.
Let me see what Madeline from, looks like Wilmington, Delaware, has to say. Madeline, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I was, one of the callers before started talking about the males part in Disney movies and of all the different fairy tales, and I like that because my partner and I, we watched the Frozen movie, and everyone's like, oh wow, the girl, she, you know, gets to be herself, and she's, but then he was all frustrated because the guy was just the same cookie cutter Disney character that they throw in for all the guys, and I think if you think of it as puzzle pieces, if it's going to be a heterosexual relationship, then the guy has to change if the girl's ever going to change. And I think that's a conversation that are very much entwined. I was wondering if you guys thought the same.
Well, I appreciate the comment to Radio Times. Linda Holmes, I mean, we are dealing in many ways in stereotypes. That's what these stories feature. But I'd be curious what you say back to Madeline.
Yeah, I think Madeline's exactly right. And one of the things I wrote about in the piece was that if anybody gets sort of less developed in early versions of this story as Disney told it than Cinderella, it's the prince, who honestly in the animated film is nothing, is almost literally a, you know, you could have him played by a popsicle stick with a paper head on it. And I think that what you get, you know, in some of these later versions, in Ever After and in the new Kenneth Branagh one, you get this effort to give him a little bit of internal conflict himself, so that he's not just presented as an object to be pursued. But I agree with Madeline that in a lot of Disney movies, especially princess movies that follow a princess, you get less development of the male character in, as she said, these heterosexual romances than you might expect. There are exceptions. I think the male character in Tangled is really funny and charming, and I enjoyed him quite a bit. But there are a lot where he's a little bit of a MacGuffin, as they say in the movies, the thing to be pursued, but not necessarily with a lot of character to him.
Let me play one more version of Cinderella. This is from Stephen Sondheim's 2014 movie version, Into the Woods. This is Anna Kendrick. She stars as Cinderella, and she's singing a song called On the Steps of the Palace. Let's give it a listen.
He's a very smart prince. He's a prince who prepares. Knowing this time I'd run from him, he spread pitch on the stairs. and I'm caught unawares. Well, it means that he cares. This is more than just malice. Better stop and take stock while you're standing here stuck on the steps of the palace. All right, what do you want? Have to make a decision. Why not stay and be caught? Should I give that a thought? What would be his response? But then what if he knew who I am when I know that I'm not what he thinks that he wants? Or then what if I am what a prince would envision? But then how can you know who you are till you know what you want, which I don't? So then which do you pick? Where you're safe, out of sight, and yourself, but where everything's wrong? Or where everything's right, but you know that you'll never belong? And whichever you pick, do it quick, because you're starting to stick to the steps of the palace.
So, Maria, what's your take on that version of Cinderella? I have to say, I love that song, but, and she sings it beautifully, Andra Kendrick. What's your thought? Maria?
From Into the Woods is that Prince Charming is not very reliable. And so we do have in many of the Disney films, these Ken figures, not so much Barbie, but Ken. I think it's important to note that that there were Cinderfellas in an earlier age. That is, these Cinder lads who spend time at the hearth and have to go out into the world and rescue themselves. Is that wonderful Jerry Lewis film?
Sure.
Called Cinderfella.
I remember
where
it.
All the roles are reversed, and if you go back and look at 19th century collections that weren't as popular, say, as the Grimm's fairy tales, you find that in fact there are quite a few sleeping princess that have to be woken up by young women. There are boys that are sent into the woods by their fathers. They become like Snow White figures. Their fathers ordered them murdered and that kind of thing. So there's huge variety. We tend to fetishize a certain canon of fairy tales, but there's a lot more out there.
Linda, we have an email from Gina. She says, I don't like Cinderella. Catty behavior in women. Beauty will get you far, and you need a man to rescue you from your miserable life. And that is a take. Yeah, go ahead.
I think that's not unfair. I mean, there is a way to look at this story in which it is entirely a story about treachery among women and about the untrustworthiness of the women in Cinderella's family, from whom only either a prince or a supernatural figure can save her, that the real menace in her life is other women. And that definitely has ugly connotations for a lot of people, and ugly connotations that resonate in other parts of popular culture and entertainment. So I think whenever you see these stories, this is why I love things like Into the Woods, is that they are examining the pieces of these stories and kind of taking them apart and turning them over. As you mentioned, I don't think there's a more important line in Into the Woods than the prince saying, "I was raised to be charming, not sincere." To kind of look under, to lift those rocks and look underneath them, and those become incredibly fascinating conversations as your take on storytelling matures.
Well, on that note, we do have to end our conversation. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Linda Holmes, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
And she writes and edits NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog. It's called Monkey See. Maria Tatar, thank you very much as well.
Great to talk.
And she's chair of the folklore and mythology program at Harvard University, also translator of the Turnip Princess and other newly discovered fairy tales. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.